is Bad Boys and Beyond with your hosts, Mike Payton and Keith Black Trudeau.
That's it, baby, I'm foul.
Like, I'll put it in the front page, back page, middle page, wherever, headliners, column one or two, we will win game two. Good back it off, we will win game two.
The game's over and the Pistons have won the world championship.
Welcome back to Bad Boys and Beyond. We are your hosts, Mike Payton and Keith Black Trudeau, and we are back with another episode, a very interesting topic today. It's kind of a dual topic. We're talking about stars who came in and had like a short trip for the Pistons, while also talking about guys who were like, oh, he played for the Pistons? Like, that's the response that I have for some of these guys. Oh, he was a Piston? Really? And I even... Keith brought up one off air, and I didn't even know about it, and I was shocked. But yeah, this is going to be a fun little topic here. We'll just kind of touch on guys. We won't go too in depth on everything because maybe we'll do some episodes on some of them later. But yeah, that's what we'll be doing today. But first, obviously, Keith, there's this 9-game losing streak, and that's happening right now. And the Pistons have the worst record in the NBA, so. Yay.
Yeah, it's been, especially after that first week, which was just full of hope and excitement.
Electric.
Everything just kind of vanished after that. I think what's going on is the offense is definitely broken. They're turning the ball over at a higher rate than any team in the league, and especially for a young team. When you get into these sequences where you're turning the ball over 4 or 5 times in 3 or 4 minutes, and then the other team hits you with a 12 to 15 point run because of that. And then you look up at the scoreboard and the game was close a second ago, and now you're getting blown out of the gym. That definitely takes a toll. And I think that's been happening to them over and over and over again, to the point where I think they're kind of resigned. I think their confidence has gone. Oh, I'll be quite frank. Now, I'm sure a lot of the veterans that are going to be coming back eventually, Isaiah Livers, Monty Morris, who could be back as soon as tomorrow, I'm hearing. Obviously, Bojan Bogdanović is the big one. He's one of the best volume shooters in the entire league. Hopefully, he still is with his, I want to say it's a knee problem that he's having. Or some kind of a bad, I forget, but it's an injury that's been hurting him since the end of last season. But if he can become the guy he was last year, I mean, that'll be a big help, even though he's a liability on defense. But in general, I'm still not going to make excuses. This team has been stockpiled with Troy Weaver's first-round draft picks. He's had 8 of them. 7 of them are still on the roster. 1 he traded for somebody else's first-round draft pick. And I'm not going to even get into him because he's not worked out either. But
Sadiq Bey, who are you talking about?
I'm sorry?
You're talking about Sadiq Bey or who are you talking about?
I'm talking about James Wiseman.
Oh, James Wiseman. Okay.
In any case, this I can understand if this team were 4-6. Even 3-7 with some heartbreaking loss. I can get all of they're not. They're 2-10. They are the worst team in the NBA by at least a number of there's not even anyone in their conversation right now. They're that bad. And look, I want to make this 100% clear. I don't discuss GM jobs midseason. I think that's silly. I think they deserve a chance to clean up whatever mess that they're in, but Troy Weaver, by the end of the season, needs to be producing a team that looks like they're going somewhere. And I said this before the season. I'm being consistent on it. But the Detroit Pistons, they need to show that they're heading in the right direction. I don't care about individual statistics, even though Asar Thompson is just amazing every night. I don't care about individual performances because those don't mean as much when they're in losses, especially blowout losses where the other team just isn't, quite frankly, isn't as focused because they know they're going to win. The Hawks game last night was a perfect example where the Hawks got up to a big early lead. They kind of played around. They let the Pistons get back in it. The Pistons actually took a lead at one point, and immediately once they did, the Hawks locked in again and took over, and the game was never really in doubt. So I'm going to give Troy Weaver this whole season to fix it before I make any proclamations, but after the trade deadline, I'm going to assume that this is the roster, whatever roster is on the other side of that. I'm going to assume that's who he's comfortable staking his job on moving forward, and then we're going to see from that point. As I'm sure everybody can tell, I'm not very happy right now. But I'm trying to be realistic about what's going on. But the bottom line is the product on the floor is not working. I do want to add one thing. I know Monty Williams said today that he's probably going to change the starting lineup, which is, to me, it's kind of overdue. Cade Cunningham has been a massive disappointment to me for most of the season. It is not entirely on him. They're not putting him in the best chances to succeed. That does not excuse the fact that he is leading the league in turnovers by a large margin, and he is not putting up the offensive numbers that the guys right behind him are putting up, which makes it a whole lot worse. So hopefully Monty Williams has an answer to this, whether it's putting Jaden Ivey in the starting lineup, which everybody wants to see, or maybe a surprise like Marcus Sasser, or maybe Monty Morris when he comes back out. Who knows? But right now we're kind of teetering on historic disaster because the Pistons have only lost 9 in a row, but looking forward, they could easily stretch this thing to 13 or 14 losses, which would be the most they've ever had in one single season consecutively. And I really don't want to have that conversation 2 weeks from now. So get a win. You know what? Get 3 wins, because I'm not sure one win is going to make me much happier.
Yeah, I think it's a few things I want to note. Keith, you said that Cade is a major disappointment, and I think that people are reading that the wrong way, what you're saying. I think people are saying that you're saying that he's a bust, and he is not a bust. He is definitely a very good player. He struggles with turnovers. I think that's really the issue that he needs to fix. Definitely needs to fix it. Am I correct in saying that you're not out here saying Cade Cunningham is a bust and this was a bad draft pick?
I'm not saying Cade Cunningham is a bust. Cade Cunningham is playing as many minutes as any player in the league. His usage is super high. He's not James Wiseman, all right? His own team isn't saying we need to take the ball out of your hands and cut your minutes because you're not good enough. My problem is he was the number one pick in the draft several years ago. I know he missed most of last season, but I am just sick and tired of pretending like his mistakes aren't happening. It is not just the turnovers. It is the fact that he is shooting 40% from the field flat and sub 30% from three after he had the first couple of weeks where he was shooting in the 40s and everyone was happy. His shooting has now plummeted to where it was when he was a rookie. In general, he is not doing anything at a superstar level. And that is, yes, that's disappointing to me. I'm not saying he can't get better. He's obviously very young, but he needs to play better than he has been playing. Everything isn't about who he has around him. Sadiq Bey picked his pocket in the fourth quarter last night, 90 feet from the basket. That had nothing to do with how many three-point shooters he had on the floor with him. That was just an absent-minded mistake. And Sadiq Bey is nobody's idea of a great defender. I still believe in Cade Cunningham. I wanted him in the draft, didn't even think about anybody else, and I still feel that way. I still think he can be a special player, but right now he is not good enough. If he's going to be a franchise player and just not another good player, he needs to show more than this. Otherwise, then we have to have a tough conversation come extension time. Is this a guy we're going to hitch the entire franchise to going forward? He needs to show more than he has, is all I'm saying. Yes, my expectations are higher. Therefore, I am harsher on him.
Yes. I mean, I will say, I do disagree with you. I don't think he's been a disappointment. I think he has some turnover issues that he needs to fix. And I think there are several instances per game where
you see five players around Cade Cunningham and everybody else is open and he's not trusting his guys. That's one problem. The other problem is he's being covered by everyone. I mean, they're guarding him like a superstar gets guarded, and he's not quite learned how to respond to that yet. But I don't think that he won't. I think that he will. And there are moments where you watch this guy play and you're just in awe of him. I mean, he's just against Milwaukee he was red hot until, you know, late in the game when it wasn't just him, everybody fell apart. But I just, you know what I'm saying? It just, there are moments you watch this guy play and you see it. You know, I think that in the last couple games, you haven't. And that's because of all the turnovers and that's because of all the attentions being paid to him. It's very similar to Aiden Hutchinson. You know, Aiden Hutchinson, everybody thinks that, or not everybody, some people think that he's not as good as, you know, what people thought he was, but he's phenomenal. But he's being double teamed on every single play, or he's being held. I mean, there's a picture or two that come out of every game where he's got somebody's arm around his neck. You know, I think it is important that you have somebody that you can rely on. And right now, I don't think Cade has that. He just doesn't have a player that he can rely on, that he trusts, that he knows that if he gets the ball to them, something good is going to happen. He doesn't have his Scottie Pippen, his whoever, his Kobe Bryant, his Shaq, whatever it may be. He doesn't have a secondary guy. He just doesn't. And I think you could see that on the floor every day, every game.
I agree with that. He does. And that, I said that at the beginning, they have not put him in a great situation to be successful at all. He very badly needs, I would go one further. I think he needs a number one scorer on his team. I think Cade Cunningham's best role is as a number two scorer on a championship team. I think he's a number three scorer. I think his role, and I said this weeks ago, is as Chris Paul. It's not Kobe Bryant. It's not Luka Doncic. It's not this guy that's going to come in and you put four shooters around him and run everything through him and he just dominate. He's more of a point guard than that. I think he's a guy that can score, but he needs to be picking his spots. He's not going to impose his will on a game offensively most nights. And that's showing up in his shooting because he's taking entirely way too many shots. He's not breaking free. He's pump faking 15 times when he gets into the lane, because that's the book on him, because he's not athletic enough to just rise over you. And you're seeing him get into the lane and pump fake the guy nine times. The guy doesn't move because everybody knows the pump fake is coming. And then he's either forced to throw up a bad shot, contested shot, or kick the ball back out with five on the shot clock. I think Cade Cunningham needs to be treated like more like a point guard and less like a do everything superstar go-to guy. I think Cade is capable of making the players around him better, but he needs a guy, and Jaden Ivey fits this description in theory, if he could ever get Monty Williams' trust defensively. But he needs someone else that is a better scorer than he is, because I would suggest looking at what Jaden Ivey did last year with no Cade Cunningham. There were no pictures of Jaden Ivey surrounded by four or five guys because he was running. No one would trap him 30 feet from the floor because he would just run by everybody and dunk the ball. Cade Cunningham doesn't have that kind of explosive athleticism, which is kind of what's making it easier to trap him. That doesn't mean he's a worse player than Jaden Ivey. I just think Jaden Ivey is a better player at getting to the basket and possibly a better scorer than Cade Cunningham is, and that's fine. I just think as the franchise, the Pistons probably need to admit that and start getting like actual real pure scorers around him. Bojan, like I said before, Bojan's probably going to be a big help if he comes back and he's healthy, but he's 34 and he's on a non-guaranteed contract after this season. He's not going to be here long-term. They need to figure out who is going to be the long-term fit next to Cade Cunningham. Asar, as much as I love Asar Thompson, he's not a guy that's going to give you a high efficient 20-some points a game, at least not anytime soon. So that needs to be first order of business for the Pistons, is to find a guy that can go out and get 25 comfortably I know those guys don't grow on trees, but I think that's the next move for them.
You know, I actually, Keith, I know a guy who just became available a couple days ago, plays for the Chicago Bulls. A lot of people are going to think it's crazy, but I mean, Zach LaVine comes in, drops 51 points on this team. Like, he is, he is not a bad shot. Like, this guy could shoot. He could do what you want. He's not long-term. You're not going to find anything long-term right now. It's not going to happen this year. But maybe you take a shot. I don't know. Maybe, you know, I think that the Pistons have a lot of assets that they are just clinging to life to, that they could probably, like Killian Hayes, James Wiseman. I mean, I'm not saying that it's going to take much more than that to pry LaVine out of Chicago. Yeah. But, like, there's guys like that you could send to Chicago and see what they could do, because this team is about to go on a full-on rebuild.
A rebuild long overdue. But
oh, absolutely.
You said it's not long term. I disagree with that, because if you look at LaVine's contract, $40 million this year, $43 million next year, $46 million the year after that, and a player option, which I promise you he's going to take, of $49 million through 2027.
Oh, okay. So that is long term.
So right? Yes, he is absolutely long term. Though I would ask you, how many assists did he have that night that he scored 51?
Well, you know, that's the thing is, I don't want Zach LaVine to come here and pass the ball. I want Zach LaVine to come here and shoot the ball.
He had zero. The answer is zero. And right. Well, I agree with you. If you want Zach LaVine, you want the score. But the problem is, he is a reluctant passer to the point that he's incredibly selfish. And he's not just selfish moving the ball. He is selfish on defense. Alec Burks, the game that they played in Detroit, Alec Burks destroyed him. And it's because he just stood there and watched Alec Burks. He didn't even contest his shot on a couple of those. There was one play I still remember where Burks got the ball on the wing. LaVine is standing right in front of him with his hands down. And rather than run the play, Burks just rose up and shot the ball over his head. And LaVine didn't even react. Look, in theory, I agree. A guy with his talent is precisely what the Pistons need. Just a walking bucket that can take the pressure off of everybody else to score points. I just really, really don't like what I see from Zach LaVine on everything else other than scoring on a night-to-night basis. He just does nothing else to help a team other than putting points on the board. And as we saw, once he scored 51 in Detroit, it often doesn't even result in a win, even when he's completely red hot. I get it. They would demand, at a very minimum, Jaden Ivey, maybe a future first, in addition to God knows how much money to make that trade work legally. I just don't know if I would like the pro. I really, really would like to see Jaden Ivey get a chance in the starting lineup before I give up on him for someone who I think Jaden Ivey could turn into a better version of.
Yeah, I guess we will see. I mean, it's only 12 games. I know it seems like this the end of the world, and here I am. I'm Mr. Optimistic. This is who I am. You know, it's not over. A lot of basketball left to be played. Maybe you figure it out. Maybe you make some deals at some point. You get some guys back healthy. We'll see what they can do. You know, I'll tell you, I'm not ready to give up. So I don't want to give up. I really don't want to.
I just, they're making it very, very difficult for me to stay optimistic. I have to see something, and I need to see it soon. I cannot go through another season like the season before, or the season before that, or the season before that. I can't. Someone's going to have to be held accountable, or someone needs to start doing their job and fix it.
Yeah, no, I think if you walk out of this season with the worst record in the league again, that's probably it for Troy. I don't see how you can continue to move on with a guy who's just can't seem to build a team. But
the thing is, I don't want to see, people think I want to see Troy Weaver. I don't, because that's what scares me, is that he's going to get let go, and then another GM will come in with his own ideas on how to build things, and he may not like what he sees, and he may start moving on from Jalen Duren or Jaden Ivey or even Cade Cunningham to get either players that he really likes instead, or to get draft picks, and then we're going to be stuck in another rebuild for another 3 or 4 more years. That's partly where my desperation is coming from, is because I don't want to see Troy Weaver fired, because that means that we're going to have to restart, at least partially restart, this rebuild all over again, and I do not want that to happen.
No, that is terrifying. Gosh. All right. Well, remember that one week where the Red Wings had just started up and they looked hot and the Pistons looked hot and the Lions obviously have been hot, and man, that was such a good week. I really missed that. Okay. Still have the Lions. Let's get to the, to today's topic. Let's start off with, I want to go back in time to a guy. Now, hold on, Keith, I'm going to name all his nicknames real quick. There's Chocolate Thunder, Double D, Doc, Dr. Dunk, Sir Slam, Zandokan the Mad Dunker, Dunk You Very Much, Candy Slam, Sweet D, Big Doc, Master of Disaster, Squawkin' Dockin', Double D Dunk, Sir Dunk, Dunk It, Peer Pleasure, Cool Breeze, Dr. Jam, and the Demon of Destin. Of course, we're talking about the legendary Daryl Dawkins, Mr. Go Up and Break the Backboard himself. He played for the Pistons, and I didn't even know that until today.
So, yeah, Daryl Dawkins, man, Chocolate Thunder himself, one of the most fun, entertaining oddities in NBA history. Some things you might not know about Daryl Dawkins. He was the very first high school player ever taken in the NBA draft. Fifth overall pick by the Sixers in 1975, just shortly after that they did away with the 4-year college rule. I mean, well, they didn't do away with it. There was a hardship clause added. But he joins the Sixers. Obviously, he wasn't good enough to play right away. But eventually, like, he started out as this guy that would just do these amazing dunks. For those of you that don't know, Daryl Dawkins, 6'10 center, real big guy, 240, 250 pounds, extremely athletic. And he first made a name for himself just in the Sixers warm-up lines, just doing these incredible dunks. And he was this guy that would not get into the game. And about his third or fourth season in the late 70s, he got himself into the rotation, eventually worked himself into the starting lineup. He was a starter on two of the Sixer teams that went to the finals in 1980 and 1982. Was not there for 1983 because they traded him to the Nets so they could make room for Moses Malone, which I think everyone can agree was a win. And from there on, without all of that superstar talent around him, I think kind of the worths started to show. Dawkins, as amazingly athletic as he was, had a pretty decent mid-range touch too, an absolutely terrible defender. Wasn't for lack of effort. His second season in New Jersey, he set the all-time NBA record for most personal fouls in a season, a record that still stands today. 386 fouls he committed in 81 games. That is an average of almost 5 fouls per game on average. He was still a good player, but not necessarily the player that people, I think, thought he was in Philadelphia. From that point on, I think the NBA kind of fell out of love with him. After Philly traded him to the Nets traded him to the Jazz for next to nothing. And then the Jazz, in turn, in early 1987, traded him to the Detroit Pistons for a second-round pick. And this was a Bad Boys team in their infancy. They didn't have James Edwards yet. They were still looking for that backup center that could give them an offensive scoring punch off the bench. Clearly was not Daryl Dawkins. And Daryl Dawkins, to be fair, had some personal issues at this point. His wife tragically took her own life about a year before the trade. He was in a very bad, dark place personally, as I'm sure anyone could understand. But he was still about around this time is when he was trying to get his career back. Didn't play at all much with the Pistons in 87, 88. Came back to training camp fresh, re-energized. He finally got his diet under control. By all accounts, he had lost, 15, 20 pounds when he showed up to training camp in 1988 for the Pistons. He looked great. The problem was that Daryl was never a guy that was living in the weight room exactly. And there was a very stark difference between losing weight and being in NBA game shape. He just wasn't working out. I think, just my opinion, I don't think he was working out the way that he needed to at his age to stay in the league. So even though he looked like he was in better shape, he really wasn't. And that kind of started to show over training camp. The Pistons gradually lost interest in him over time until they eventually did let him go shortly before the trade deadline in 1989. And as they moved on to go and get Mark Aguirre from the Dallas Mavericks. And that was kind of his very, very short-lived Pistons career. Now, he was a fan favorite. He was kind of like their Darko Milicic, only, old instead of really young. Fans used to cheer for him to get him into the game during blowouts. I'm not sure how he felt about that because he was an established player. It's not like he was just happy to get in there. But I think he was just trying to keep his spot in the league. This story kind of, if you look on Basketball Reference, it'll show you that Dawkins played his last NBA minutes with the Pistons, which is true. But that nearly wasn't the case. The following year, the Orlando Magic was one of two expansion franchises to enter the league, along with Minnesota. And he actually expressed a lot of interest in playing for the Orlando Magic. And he came down there, and it was kind of this weird thing where he was willing to sign with Orlando, but obviously Pat Williams, the general manager of the Magic, he wanted to work him out first. He wanted him to earn his spot in camp, and Dawkins wasn't willing to do that. And it just turned into this negative fiasco where Dawkins winds up storming out of camp with his warm-up still on, with no contract, and that was kind of it. And he finished his career in Italy.
I would be remiss if I didn't bring up that Daryl Dawkins. So in the 80s, Nike basketball made these posters that maybe you've seen. Keith, you've seen my Moses Malone shirt that I have. It's Moses Malone standing with a whatever that thing is that Moses from the Bible had, a staff. I don't know. And he's got basketballs.
The classic poster, yeah.
Yes. So I think that Daryl Dawkins has the coolest poster that Nike ever produced. And it's Daryl standing in a pile of glass holding the rim. And he has a shirt on that says Lovetron. The reason he has a shirt on that says Lovetron is because he proclaimed himself an alien to be from the planet of Lovetron. Which, I mean, nobody was like Daryl Dawkins. Like, I mean, he was a character for sure.
Yeah. Dawkins, I forgot to mention, Dawkins is famous for smashing backboards in the early part of his career. That was one of the attractions about coming to see him play. I'm sorry, go on.
And I know that the people can't see this because this is a podcast, but Keith, you can at least see what I have right here in front of me. What I'm about to add to my cart is the shirt with that very poster on it, and I cannot wait for it to get here. I also got to get my Dr. Duncanstein shirt, my Daryl Griffith shirt as well at some point. All right, let's move on. Let's go. We'll stay in the older days. Let's go with the Do. Tell us about the Do.
The Do, or as he was known in Detroit as the Don't.
Bob McAdoo.
One of the most offensively gifted big men, at least scoring wise, big men ever. And it's not even a debate. 1973 wins Rookie of the Year with the Buffalo Braves. If that name sounds unfamiliar to you, they are now known as the Los Angeles Clippers. And within, his third year in the league, he was named MVP. He won the NBA scoring title 3 years in a row, 74, 75, 76. Averaged more than 30 points a game in all of those seasons. Had a 50-point playoff game in the middle of that. Buffalo, good team, never a great team. He was never able to lead them all the way to the finals. But the point being, Bob McAdoo, extremely dominant player, amazing player. And also his career kind of hit. He kind of hit his twilight almost in his late 20s just because he didn't – I don't know if it was injury or if he was just – he didn't keep himself in the best shape. I don't know. I do know that personality-wise, he was not well-liked in any of the locker rooms that he played for until the very last one, which he had no choice but to play the good soldier. But I will say this, just after his third scoring title, he was traded to the Knicks – for John Guarinelli. That's right, John Guarinelli. This is a man that was coming off three straight scoring titles, averaging 30 a game and an MVP season, and then he was traded to the Knicks for John Guarinelli. That was where his value was at, still in his supposedly his athletic prime in his mid-20s. And with the Knicks, he makes his final All-Star game. Doesn't really do a whole lot. His numbers dip a little bit, and the Knicks flip him to the Celtics for Tom Baker in a 79 first. Again, this reflects what his value was at in the league at that point. But good old Dick Vitale, who was running the Pistons through owner Bill Davidson at the time, he didn't see it that way. He still remembered the good old days of watching him score 50 in the playoffs with the Buffalo Braves. So, as part of a sign-in trade, he sends the Celtics, and we've been over this. This is the third time I've mentioned this on the show. Two 1980 first-round picks, one owed, I believe, from the Bullets and his own. And this was in 1979, so this was the season before that draft. And his big idea was to pair Bob Lanier, who was the best center in my mind in Pistons history, most dominant, with Bob McAdoo. And look, in theory, I can almost see what Dick Vitale was looking at, because both McAdoo and Lanier could both shoot. They both had, they were probably the two best deep shooting bigs of this 1970s. So theoretically, they should have been able to space the floor for each other. The problem was neither of them were. It was about to become 1980. It wasn't the 70s anymore. Both of these guys were older, much slower, especially Lanier with his deteriorating knee that had to be drained every other week out of fluid. They could not play in the perimeter anymore, at least not like they used to. So what happens when, you know, older big men start to get wear and tear as they play closer to the basket so they can keep getting rebounds, keep getting points inside? And that's kind of what happened with Lanier and McAdoo. They played 30 games together. It was 37 total, but McAdoo only played 30 of those. Lanier played all 37. They both averaged 20 points a game. McAdoo averaged 20 and 8. Lanier averaged 21 and 10. But here's the thing. The Pistons were 9 and 28 in those 37 games. It was a catastrophe from the get-go. It was clear that these guys couldn't really play together, and certainly Dick Vitale was way in over his head trying to coach them to play together. Lanier, that was the last straw for Lanier. Dick Vitale was fired 2 weeks into or 3 weeks into the season, long before either of these guys got moved. Jack McCloskey, the great Pistons GM, took over. He saw the mess he inherited. Couldn't do anything about McAdoo. Couldn't trade him. Nobody wanted him anymore, especially with his contract. But teams did want Bob Lanier, so he shipped Bob Lanier off after 37 games to Milwaukee for their first-round pick, which, given how good they were, didn't amount to much. It was a late first. and McAdoo just kind of was stuck in Detroit for the rest of the season. And it got worse the following season. So as Tom Wilson, who was president of the Pistons for a very long time, he was Bill Davidson's right-hand man. As I recall how he told it, McAdoo comes into camp and says he wants a new contract, a longer contract. And his knee is going to start hurting again if he doesn't get it. This is according to Tom Wilson. And at that point, the Pistons were already terrible. They had the worst record in team history that season before. 16-66, a game worse than the Pistons were last year. It was absolutely terrible. And they looked at McAdoo and his representation like, what are we paying them? What are we paying for? We gave up the first round pick to get you, and it wound up being the first pick in the draft because you were so bad. We were the worst team in the league with you. So, long story short, they simply released McAdoo shortly into the 80-81 season. They had no interest in holding on to him any longer. Now, McAdoo does get his revenge, however, as much as it hurts me to say this. McAdoo later signs on with the Nets. And the Nets are actually able to trade him to the Lakers for a second round pick. They actually got something for him, which the Pistons never did. So he goes to the Lakers and decides that his knee is healthy again and he's motivated to play. And he is a very valued sixth man of the very early versions of the Showtime Lakers. Goes to multiple NBA finals with them. Wins two championships as the sixth man, backing up Kareem and Jamal Wilkes for the Lakers. So McAdoo's story actually has a very happy ending, and he's known in retrospect for his days in Buffalo winning scoring titles and his days at the very end with the Lakers being a valuable role player off the bench and helping Magic and Kareem and Jamal Wilkes and James Worthy win championships. As a Pistons fan from this perspective, it just burns me every time I talk about Bob McAdoo because he dug the Pistons a very large hole and walked out of it and somehow got rewarded.
Yep. And well, he's also going to get mentioned on one of the final episodes of our show, The Winning Time, where Rambis gets put in the starting lineup over McAdoo, and Jerry West is like, you know, I mean, you can't do this. This is the do that we're talking about. And yeah, I thought that was funny. So I'm gonna take one here next, because this is a really short one. There's really not a whole lot to talk about, I should say. So in 1997, I went to a basketball game at the Palace of Auburn Hills. And you actually sent me the tape of this game. Everyone was out. Grant was out. Dumars was out. Like, pretty much everybody was injured. But they were playing this new guy that they had just got. And I went over to – I had a Pistons shirt, and I went over to get autographs by the tunnel where the players were coming out. And Terry Mills signed my shirt, and Rick Mahorn signed my shirt. And then Kenny Smith walks up, and I go, Kenny Smith plays here? I didn't say it out loud, but I'm like, when did Kenny Smith start playing here? Because we didn't have the internet like we do now, where you just know these things.
Right.
And if you didn't catch it on the radio or on SportsCenter or whatever, you just found out later. And I just found out that night that Kenny Smith had signed with the Pistons a few days earlier. And I just always thought that was interesting, because now I have this shirt signed by Kenny Smith, and he only played here for 9 games. And it was pretty, unspectacular, I would say. It wasn't like he lit the world up. He averaged 2.6 points per game, and then was waived by the team, after 9 games, and he went to Orlando for 6 games, and then played 33 games for the Nuggets before he retired. And now, obviously, we all know Kenny as from TNT, and he's such a big part of the NBA experience these days. But yeah, I just wanted to share that personal anecdote. But if you have any deeper things to say about Kenny Smith, let's hear them.
No, I thought Kenny Smith was a pretty good fit. I was kind of disappointed that Doug Collins waived him because he just wasn't in the best of shape. He was only 31, but he just didn't really have it in him to play much longer. Like, coming off of those Rockets championship teams, I think it probably, once the Rockets released him in 96, I just don't think he could find a reason to get really interested in playing basketball anymore. With the Pistons, he averaged 2 points, but he shot 5 for 10 from three in a very small amount of games. So it's not like his shot abandoned him. Doug Collins does not suffer guards that don't defend, and Kenny Smith clearly wasn't willing to do that anymore. So he was perfectly happy to wait. He didn't even replace him with anyone. He just waived him and just moved Latrell Green up to the emergency backup because Latrell Green guarded people. Even though maybe three people listening to our show have ever heard of Latrell Green.
Oh, I know Latrell Green.
I promise you, he was a real person.
Yes.
But yeah, this is kind of, you know, where Kenny Smith's career goes, retiring early for a 10-year NBA player. 31 is still pretty early. And he goes straight into broadcasting with TNT, where he still is today. And I think everyone can agree it was a great career move for him, because, you know, he found his true calling, which was being part of inside the NBA as an analyst. I still enjoy his work to this day.
And then just a few years later, we get to hear the greatest commentary of the slam dunk contest of all time from him. I would say Vince Carter.
Yeah,
it's over. I mean, it's an iconic moment. Like, you just, but, and he was the soundtrack to that iconic moment.
Yeah, but he also killed it by being the one judge that didn't give Vince Carter a 50 on all of his dunks. He gave him like an 8, or I think it was like an 8 on his second or third dunk, because he said he raised the bar so high that he couldn't, like, the third dunk wasn't as good as the first two. And that was his, he was the only judge. He was the only judge that did not give him a 10 on everything.
Yeah, he's crazy. And
it was almost like he did that for attention. Like, Vince Carter's, every one of Vince Carter's dunks was worthy of a 50. And I guess Kenny just decided to be different that day because he knew it wouldn't make a difference. I don't know.
Oh, Kenny. I wonder what Chuck would say about that. So who do you want to move on to next?
I want to go to, you did a short one. I'm going to do a short one.
Okay.
Dale Davis. And have one of the few basketball players, that I thought was bad boy tough, that didn't play for the Bad Boys, came to the league a little bit after their time. 92, 93 was his rookie season. Just one of the toughest guys. Kind of his mentality was a lot like Isaiah Stewart, where he was pretty stoic. He was just tough. But if you did something to make him snap, he would go 0 to 100. Like, there's videos of him choking a guy, literally choking a guy for going. I think it was Michael Smith on the Kings. That when, I think he pushed him in the back on a rebound or something, and Dale just lost it. And there's video of him, like, with his hands around his neck, like, choking the air out of him. I loved watching Dale Davis play. A fixture in Indiana during all of the Reggie Miller years, capped his career off in Indiana with an all-star season in 2000. Big as hell, 6'10", 250, 260, solid muscle, and had a fair amount of athleticism as well. Could go up and grab lob dunks. He was just everybody's ideal power forward of the 1990s. And he did Indiana another favor. They were, after the 2000 final season, when they broke up that team, they moved him on to Portland, who badly needed another body to throw at Shaq. And in turn, they sent him their best prospect, which was Jermaine O'Neal. So he became the gift that kept on giving for the Pacers, because O'Neal turned into an MVP candidate at one point in his career. But from that point on, Dale started to get old, as most big men do when they're mid-30s. The Blazers obviously made a huge mistake in trading for him, because they were never good enough to compete with the Lakers anyway after 2000. So they moved him on to Golden State for Nick Van Exel. A year after that, Golden State essentially salary dumps him to the Hornets in the Baron Davis deal. And they waive him. So things come full circle. Reggie Miller's going into his... He's actually in the midst of his final season in Indiana after 19 seasons. Dale Davis signs at Indiana to be with his buddy Reggie Miller to the end. Actually plays some really inspired ball. It's the best he had played in, I think, 3 or 4 years to that point. And he gets to the playoffs as part of their rotation. They lose to the Pistons. And in what I think is the ultimate irony, because I've said this on the show before. I have a lot of friends that are Indiana Pacers fans, or a lot of acquaintances that are Indiana Pacers fans going back 20 years. And the Pacers absolutely hated the Pistons, especially after the brawl, the 11 November 19th brawl. So, and Dale Davis was one of their favorite players of all time. So it absolutely crushed them when Dale Davis left the Pacers after Reggie retired to be with his other best friend, Rasheed Wallace, in Detroit. And that was kind of his main motivation, because with his best friend out of the – or his best player friend out of the league, his second best was probably Rasheed Wallace. So he signs with the Pistons for a couple of years. And as a Pistons fan, I was maybe the only person in the world super excited to have Dale Davis, a guy in his late 30s that didn't really have any pop, could never shoot. He was just kind of there for six fouls in case they ran into Shaq in the playoffs. He was like their Eldon Campbell replacement, I'll put it that way. And he really doesn't play a whole lot. He does start 8 games over 2 years with the Pistons. His field goal percentage is not great because he didn't have that explosiveness anymore. And that was the only way he ever scored, was by dunking the ball. And yeah, I want to say he played, what did he play? 81 total playoff minutes over 2 years. He didn't get off the bench much, but when he did, he was still the old Dale Davis. He still worked his ass off. He still intimidated people. He had a couple of memorable blocks that I can remember. But for the most part, he was the 12th man on the team. Well, 11th, because Darko was never getting off the bench. But anyway, he was the last guy on the team that they would consider putting into the game in a clutch situation. This has mainly just been my soundboard to talk about how much I appreciate Dale Davis and how much it just tickles me that I have memories of him playing for the Detroit Pistons. I thought that was just like a gift to me as a fan, the coolest thing ever.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, players were getting choked back then, and now we learned just the other night that players are still getting choked in the NBA, thanks to Draymond.
That was a full-on sleeper hole.
That was a, and he carried it around he carried Gobert around the court for like 10 minutes, and nobody did anything to stop him. I just thought that was wow. Must tell you how people feel about Rudy Gobert on his team. I guess they just kind of let it happen. But all right, let's. I got another super short one. This guy is one of the most legendary players to ever come out of the city of Detroit. I mean, we're talking about, when you look at it, this is one of the greatest basketball players to ever play in the city of Detroit. And I'm not saying as a Piston, I'm saying as a high schooler. And this guy would go on to become the number one draft pick in the NBA draft. Of course, I'm talking about Derek Coleman, who, after years of being a phenomenal player, a multi-time All-Star, two-time All-NBA, he decides he wants to come to play for the Pistons. The year after they win the championship, he joins the 2005 Detroit Pistons team. and it is a nightmare. It's horrible for him. He plays 5 games with the Pistons. He never really sees the court. He was getting points, 10 minutes per game, and in 5 games, that's like nothing. He actually went on the Knuckleheads podcast and talked about how that was the worst time in his career and how like he wishes he never would have came here because Larry Brown refused to play him. And he winds up retiring after that. Now he obviously still lives in Detroit and is still a part of the community and everything. But his run with the Pistons was not a good one.
Okay, so if I can just mention one thing. Yes. It wasn't a free agency signing. He was actually the return from the Corliss Williamson trade when the Pistons were dumping salary because Bill Davidson said, we paid the luxury tax last year because we were $500,000 over the threshold. We're not going to do it again this year. You need to move some salary. So Corliss winds up being the odd man out. They move him for Derek Coleman, who has had far less money on his contract. And that's why he's kind of stuck in Detroit. But yeah, you're right. On everything else, it was kind of a miserable existence for him. He just wasn't that interested in having a career anymore, I don't think. At least not as interested in it as he needed to be at age 37. You know, like once you get in your late 30s, you need to be living in the gym. You need to be more serious about playing than everybody else that's half your age that you're playing against. And Derek Coleman, even in his prime, was never really that guy. It's kind of funny when you were talking about, when you were introducing him, I thought you were going to talk about Chris Webber. I wanted to stop you. Oh, we already covered him in one in wonders. But it's kind of interesting that these are two guys with almost identical qualifications. But yeah, Derek Coleman was a much more fun player for the Nets, I think, than he was anywhere else. And it's kind of odd because Larry Brown, 2 years before that, Larry Brown had him with the Sixers and he had him in the playoff rotation. So it's not like he hated Derek Coleman. He just didn't think that Derek Coleman was good enough, in good enough shape to play anymore. And he was right, because once Derek Coleman was released, no one else picked him up.
Yep. And but hey, shout out to Derek Coleman. Detroit native, still lives here. Drove water back and forth from Detroit to Flint during the height of the Flint water crisis. Like, just a stand-up guy, cares about the state and the people that live in it. And you gotta love that.
Very, very, very proud Detroiter and overall Michigander Derek Coleman is. Even though he's kind of out of the spotlight now, he's always represented.
Let's talk about one more one, and then we'll get to I guess the main events, the ones that everybody tuned in for, I suppose. Another number one overall draft pick from the 1980s. I'm talking about another multi-time All-Star, 1998 Sixth Man of the Year, Danny Manning. Played for the Pistons for 13 games, he existed here. That's basically what it was. If you Google him, you'll find one picture, and he has Michael Stewart of the Cleveland Cavaliers' ass in his face. Somebody is selling his Pistons jersey on eBay. I don't know who would have acquired a Danny Manning Pistons jersey. I don't know if this is Danny Manning who is selling his own jersey, but it's for $800. So it's game used, it says. This might be Danny Manning actually selling his old stuff. Who knows? But there's actually one game where he played a lot. And Keith, you know about that game.
So, yeah, Danny Manning, for some background reference, because if for nothing else, Bryce Simon, if he's listening to this, is going to want me to talk about Danny Manning for about an hour. And I'm just not going to do that. But I will give him his flowers. Danny Manning, one of the greatest Kansas Jayhawk players ever, led them almost single-handedly to the 1988 NCAA title. He has the unfortunate fate of being drafted to the Donald Sterling Los Angeles Clippers with the number one pick in 1988. look, he's still very good. He at a certain point in 1988, or excuse me, in 1993 and 94, he is an all-star, kind of a do everything, 6'10", kind of on the skinny side, but 6'10", power forward, could play the three if you needed him to, could play center if you needed him to, was not great at any one thing, but he there was nothing that he couldn't do. He could handle the ball, he could shoot a little bit, he could post, he could rebound, he could defend. You could see all of the things that made him a great college basketball player. And he goes from the Clippers to the Hawks in the infamous trade of Dominique Wilkins that banished him from Atlanta to the Clippers. And the less I talk about that trade, the better, because we'll be here until midnight. Manning leaves Atlanta after half a season, goes to Phoenix for what's essentially a sweetheart deal. Under the understanding that when the Suns had cap that they would pay him, and they did. Unfortunately, his best chance to win a championship, he tears his ACL for the third or fourth time with the Phoenix Suns in 95. And they probably, I think, would have won the championship with him. I think he was that impactful with them. But from that point on, after a pretty good career in Phoenix, as you said, wins the Sixth Man of the Year award at one point, well-deserved. Goes to Milwaukee, not very good for the off the bench for the Bucks. Goes to the Jazz, not great for them. And you can see where this is going. And he's in his mid to late 30s. He's bouncing around the league. Goes to Dallas, and then finally winds up with Larry Brown, his college coach. Things come full circle with the Detroit Pistons. And this is almost like his farewell landing spot, because I think everyone kind of knew he was done. I don't even know if he would have had a spot in the league if Larry Brown didn't want him. Danny Manning is on the team. He signs, I think, in February, like midseason. He wasn't even in the league prior to that. And he's kind of like the 12th man on that team. Just the professional veteran that shows up every day, works hard, never gets into the games, because the Pistons in the early 2000s were an extremely durable team. Very few players ever got hurt for any extended period. But as you mentioned, he does get into one game for a fairly large amount of time. And I'm going to mention this anyway. Oh, actually, hold up. There was another what game am I thinking of? It should have been December. I can't even remember. Why am I not seeing this? Yeah, I need to stop for a second, because I just lost my train of thought. All right, so I misremembered something. All right, so there was one game in Boston that he played a fair amount, and the Pistons beat the Celtics by 58 points in the Garden. He played a fair amount that night, but the game that I'm thinking of is actually a game that they lost. It is the second time that they visited Boston that year. They lost by 7, but he actually played 31 minutes, went 7 of 14, 2 for 4 from three-point range, scored 18 points. This was essentially their last game of the season. Going into where they didn't really care if they won or they lost. And it was actually a pretty good send off for him. He does play a little bit in the playoffs, but it's all in blowout minutes. It really doesn't matter. But yeah, it is kind of interesting that, you know, he finishes his career for the same guy that he won the NCAA championship for. Why am I not? Jesus, we need to just cut this whole thing.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
No, because I just realized that Larry Brown was not the coach of the Detroit Pistons in 2003, where Carlisle was. So, yeah,
but that's okay. It's all right to admit your mistakes live on the air, Keith. I do it all the time.
Yeah. So
I do it every episode.
Yeah, but I feel silly now, because I had that century. Oh, that makes sense. He signed because of Larry Brown. No, he didn't. Rick Carlisle was the coach in 2003.
Well, he signed because he saw the future, And he knew that Larry Brown was going to get that job. That's why he signed it. The only problem was he did not foresee that he was going to be released.
We will go with that.
All right, let's get to the two big ones. We'll start here with a player that is one of the greatest players of all time. They're both these guys that we're going to talk about are the two of the greatest players of all time. But this one, drafted straight out of high school to the Toronto Raptors, really fun there, and then goes to Orlando and just becomes a monster. Just seemingly overnight, just becomes this. He killed everyone on the court. Had a hell of a run. Then goes to Houston, has maybe one of the greatest. I can't remember how long of a sequence it was, but one of the greatest, like, 57 seconds of basketball ever played against I can't remember which team that was against, but the Spurs, actually, where he scores like 27 points in 57 seconds. I'm exaggerating, but it was insane. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Then he obviously he starts to kind of fizzle out as a player, gets traded to the New York Knicks. Obviously, I'm talking about Tracy McGrady here, by the way. And then winds up in Detroit for just 1 year, 2011. Plays 79 games, starts 39 of them. Comes off the bench mostly, scores 8 points a game. Keith and I have a different remembering of how this went, because Keith remembers it as a horrible down point of an otherwise Hall of Fame career. And I remember it more as an old really great player who comes in as a good mentor, solid veteran minutes, and really, you know, it was like the last good, decent year of his career before he eventually would just, he'd be done. He'd go play in China in 2 years and that was it. But I just remember Tracy McGrady being on the team, knowing that he wasn't Tracy McGrady anymore, but still feeling like, oh no, that's good. Like, he's good. He's coming off the bench. He's helping these young guys. He's doing it. You know, he's doing the best that he can here, but like, we don't expect that he's going to be that Tracy McGrady anymore.
So yeah, Tracy McGrady on the Pistons. And it's really weird, 'cause he was only 31 when they signed him. There was a lot of superstars like him that are still in their athletic prime at 31. And with Tracy, it was like he looked like a 39-year-old. The explosion was just all the way gone. Fortunately, Tracy was 6'8", fairly well put together. He could still manufacture baskets. He could still exist on the court as like a power forward. But it just wasn't the same guy. And as a starter, he did fairly well. For a guy that was low usage, he averaged double figures while he was in the starting lineup. It just wasn't able to last. They took him out of the starting lineup after a while when it was clear that he couldn't handle that workload anymore. And Tracy, look, he was a guy that was happy coming to work every day. He tried to provide the veteran leadership. He tried to keep things positive in the locker room, even though it was a very bad team. He did all the things that you would expect a veteran minimum salary guy that's like your 11th or 12th man to do. The problem was he wasn't a role player. Like, he was Tracy McGrady. And to see him, I don't want to say reduced, because I feel like I'm putting down role players by saying reduced, but for someone of his stature who is used to being, you know, the leader, the guy that could carry a team by himself, and he's out being like a rich man's Michael Curry. I get it. I don't think he has anything to be sorry about for his 1 year in Detroit. It was just, it didn't feel, especially on a losing team where he wasn't even helping them win anything. It was just not a great memory, I would say, where it did. He had maybe one or two games where, yeah, he would get an open floor dunk, and fans would, you know, they would get excited because, hey, Tracy McGrady just dunked a basketball. You know, I remember 2003. That was fun. And just from a guy that nearly beat the Pistons by himself in 2003, by averaging like 45 points a game. And then he comes to Detroit 7 years later and he's averaging like 8. It was, I would say it was kind of jarring and a little bit awkward.
Well, he did have a 22 point game against the Toronto Raptors. It was a win. Put up 22 points that game. That's pretty impressive for old Tracy McGrady. I my only homework for Pistons fans or anybody young enough to not remember it is to go search out that Tracy McGrady comeback video against the Spurs. It's 13 points in 33 seconds. That's what it is. And it is freaking incredible to watch this happen because it is a player that is hot and knows he's hot and just knows he's going to make every shot. Like, and when a guy can get like that, magical things happen. All right. So let's do it. Let's talk about it. Obviously Allen Iverson is the one that maybe a lot of people are here to listen to. Let me start off by saying this, and I don't think that Pistons fans are going to want to hear this. I think there's a lot of revisionist history surrounding the Allen Iverson trade. And what I mean by that is everybody is like, oh, but the thing I hated the most is that they traded Chauncey Billups. Like, I just don't believe that because I know my own personal experience is my roommate slamming on my door in the morning saying, we got Allen Iverson, and me being incredibly excited about getting Allen Iverson. I was like, oh man, I like Chauncey, but this is Allen Iverson. We're talking about one of the greatest basketball players of all time. Love Chauncey, love him. But this was Allen Iverson, man. And I mean, I can only speak to my experience, I guess, but I think that a lot of people, I'm guessing, obviously, I think a lot of people had the same experience that I did. And after realizing how bad that it had gone, obviously flipped that experience and it went to, oh, I can't believe we got rid of Chauncey Billups. That's me. Keith, how were you feeling at that time? You're a little bit more deep basketball minded than I am. I go, flashy lights, superstar. I get excited about that stuff. I mean, I was excited about the Blake Griffin trade.
Okay, so I think that trade was a perfect reflection of how spoiled Pistons fans were in the late 2000s. We're coming off a 59-win season. People were treating the team as stale. They had the second-best record in the entire NBA, and people were treating them like they were stale bread, like, this team's boring. I want something new and flashy. I want a superstar. And I think everybody kind of underestimated just how rare having teams like that is, how rare having a core group that can go to the conference finals year after year after year after year is. And Allen Iverson comes in, and you're right, I think there was a lot of excitement offhand, but people don't understand that was a rebuild move by Joe Dumars. That was not a, I need to get Allen Iverson. That was a, I want to get out of Chauncey Billups' contract so I can clear some cap space and have some flexibility for 2009. That's exactly what it was. The thought was if Allen Iverson comes to Detroit and plays well, all the better. He's going to be here for a year regardless. And Allen Iverson, I think there's the revisionist history to me is that Allen Iverson was terrible, that he was washed up, that he didn't want to play. And the immediate impact was he was okay. He was not the same guy he used to be. Like, he just wasn't. He couldn't get to the same spots. He wasn't used to playing how the Pistons played, which was a very much a team-oriented style of ball. He's used to being an isolation guy and just making moves. It was a very bad fit for him all around, but he did have moments. It wasn't like Tracy McGrady where he just physically couldn't do it anymore, or he looked like a guy that was barely holding on. No, Allen Iverson still had maybe 60% of his prime left in him. Here are some games that he put together. He put together, I think, what, 44 against the Utah Jazz, 40, something like that, against Deron Williams. He put 31 on Tony Parker, 27 on Mike Conley, He had 22 plus the game winner right over Russell Westbrook. These are a lot of the guys that would go on to dominate the next decade at the point guard position. And he was giving them the business. He dropped 25, one of his best games. He went on the road in LA in Staples against the NBA's most dominant team that season, which was the LA Lakers. The Pistons won that game, and he might have been the best player on the court, offensively anyway. The point being, even though he wasn't MVP Allen Iverson anymore, he was still capable of getting you 25 to 30 on a night where he was feeling physically well. And the problem is that the Pistons, they weren't willing to treat him like a superstar. They were all about moving forward. Rodney Stuckey was Joe Dumars. I think Joe saw Rodney Stuckey as his Darko redemption story. He was drafted with the draft pick that they got in return for Darko. And I think that message was kind of sent down to the bench where Michael Curry took over as head coach. And I think that message was that you need to start finding Rodney Stuckey more minutes. And the problem is that you had one Hall of Famer and one perennial All-Star starting ahead of him, and Allen Iverson and Rip Hamilton. And of course, Curry's not a dummy. The first thing he did was try to ask Rip Hamilton to come off the bench, which was disrespectful as hell, but he knew what was going to happen when he asked Iverson. So Rip does it, and Rodney Stuckey and Iverson were just such a bad pairing. And eventually that doesn't work out, so he goes to ask Allen Iverson to come off the bench a few months later, and Allen Iverson is just not having it. Like, Rip and Allen Iverson will both tell you that they tried to make it work. They were trying to figure out how to play together. It wasn't that they didn't like each other. They had never played with each other before, and they were both unique players. And Michael Curry just, at one point, with the Pistons, were kind of around 500. They were nowhere near what they were a year ago, but they were still okay. They were still threatening to make the playoffs. And Curry essentially just pulls the rug out from both of them and says, Rodney Stuckey is more important than both of you. And it turned both of them. It kind of ended the career for not just Allen Iverson in Detroit, but Rip Hamilton in Detroit, because I don't think he ever got over that. So, yeah, how the story ends is the thing everyone remembers, is that Allen Iverson, stays out late at Motown Casino, gets drunk, and has to get escorted out. And he kind of embarrasses himself publicly. And eventually the Pistons just decide to tell Allen Iverson, just take your money and leave. We don't want you anymore. Don't show up to practice. You're banned from the practice facility. So the Pistons spend the next, month and a half without Allen Iverson. They do make the playoffs. They get swept by the Cavs. But I think the distinction here is that I think there is a world where it does work out, at least for one season. They never would have been the team that they were the year before with Chauncey. I think that's a given. But there is a world where you give Rip and Allen Iverson 80 games to figure it out, and they may have given someone a scare in the playoffs. It may have been better than what it was.
Yeah, we know a lot more now about what went wrong with Allen Iverson. He just mentally wasn't there. Like, there was just a lot going on in his life. And there's a phenomenal documentary simply called Iverson. I think you could probably find it on YouTube. It's like an hour and a half long. Really, really good. And you'll come away with it with a whole different point of view of how the end of his career went. And also the practice thing that's infamous. Like, you understand why he didn't show up to practice and all that stuff. Really good documentary. It didn't work out, but I will go ahead and say that he may have had the greatest pass in Pistons history, that full court bounce to
Tayshaun. It was a really good one. Let's not go overboard. But it was, yes, exactly the pass you're talking about.
Can you remember another one? Can you remember another pass that made you go, oh my God, I'm going to remember that forever?
Yeah. I mean, Isaiah Thomas had three or four of those, but That's beside the point. It was. I don't want to take away from it. I just don't want to go forward. It is a very memorable pass, and I think it speaks to that both you and I remember it, and I think a lot of Pistons fans from that time would remember that pass too. It was a really, really beautiful 70-foot bounce pass, one bounce through like three legs from Iverson to Rip for a layup. Rip, of course, the long story is that. Yeah, the Pistons lost that game, but that was a great moment. I think that showed that they were trying to put it together. They just didn't have enough time.
Well, now Allen Iverson is a big part of the Reebok brand, and so is Shaq. And I got to tell you, man, I've said it on Twitter a few times. I'm really excited to see what they're going to do, because there was a time when Reebok had some really great shoes, like the Iverson shoes, for example. Were awesome. Everybody had a pair. I'm really excited to see if they're able to recreate some magic there, because we need more options. It's as simple as that. And Reebok's also always been a little bit cheaper than the Nikes and the Adidas of the world. So yeah, I'm excited to see what they come up with. Even though, look, I'm staring at a pair of shoes that I paid $230 for. So I'm not against spending money on shoes, but I would love a cheaper pair of basketball shoes. But yeah, that's going to wrap up today's episode. We are going to come back at you next week with the 2019 NBA draft. Now, Keith, last week we covered a very deep, very awesome draft. This is not that. I mean,
that's usually the story. Whenever you get a really great draft, class, The one that follows it is usually not very good.
No, there's definitely some names there. You got Tyler Hero. Obviously, this is the Ja Morant Zion draft. Yep. Darius Garland. There's some guys there to get out of the draft. I can guarantee you that we're not going to be taking Sekou Doumbouya with our little extra pick at the end there, or at all. He's not going to be drafted. But we'll see you guys. Next week, 2019 NBA draft.